When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hey folks, this is Kevin. On this week's episode of Risk, you'll hear Margot Lightman.
She points to the picture. She's like, it's Henry Winkler. He's coming to you. You summoned him. And I was like, oh my God.
That and more. But first, no one really has time to go to the post office. We're all too busy. But Stamps.com brings all the amazing services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your computer. You simply use your computer to print official U.S. postage 24/7 for any letter, any package, any class of mail, anywhere you want to send. Once your mail's ready, just hand it to your mail carrier or drop it in the mailbox. It's that simple. With Stamps.com, you get 5 cents off every first-class stamp and up to 40% off priority mail. Not to mention, it's a fraction of the cost of those expensive postage meters. No wonder over 700,000 small businesses already use Stamps.com. And right now, Risk listeners get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage. And there's Donkey. Donkey, he uses Stamps.com and he loves it. And right now, Risk listeners get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a digital scale without any long-term commitment. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Risk. That's Stamps.com. Enter Risk. Now here's the show. Hello, kids. This is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison. This is Chris Lightcap's Big Mouth behind me now. And we are calling this week's episode Finding a Way. I just got back from Salt Lake City. We had a fantastic Risk show there. And as you know, we've got one coming up at Fort Lauderdale on May 16th, so be sure and pitch us for that one. We've already cast the show that we're doing in Richmond on April 12th, and we're in the process of adding a whole slew of new dates for the late spring and summer. So stay tuned for all that news. I'm going to be doing an Ask Me Anything, an AMA, one of my audio check-ins that I do on Patreon for all our Patreon subscribers. So email me at kevin@risk-show.com and send your questions. I'm going to do a few of these, I think. And I'm very excited that we finally have a new radio-style story on the show again today. It's been a while. But before we get to that, I want to bring one of our favorites. Margot Lightman is returning to the show. Without Margot, there might not be a Risk show. Margot plays a central role in the origin story of the Risk podcast. It's all right there in the introduction for the Risk book. If you don't have it yet, you're missing out on a real treat, that Risk book, my friends. Speaking of books, Margot is the author of the bestseller Long Story Short, The Only Storytelling Guide You'll Ever Need, and her follow-up book, What's Your Story, is coming out this summer, but it's available for pre-order now. And here she is. This is Margot Lightman with a story we call Oh, Henry.
Hello. I think we've all heard the news a few weeks ago that our beloved Penny Marshall passed away, which was very intense for, I think, a lot of us. She was very important to a lot of us, very important to me as well. I idolized her as a kid, and she was a big reason why I decided to go to school and study theater, because I was so obsessed with her comedic portrayal in Laverne and Shirley as a little girl. And when I went off to college, my dad, as a gift, bestowed me with this 8x10 glossy photograph of Henry Winkler as the Fonz. And I was like, it's close, but it's not the one I like. I like Penny Marshall. You gave me a picture of the guy on the show that Laverne and Shirley's the spinoff of. It's a different situation, but I know he meant well. So I hung it up on my wall when I got to college. And it was like this real conversation started. I have a picture of Henry Winkler as the Fonz. It was like this really glossy, smiley shot. And that people would walk in. And it was the only thing I had on my wall. And they thought, it was just fun, you know? I would like hook up with a lot of guys underneath it. And I kept it up for 4 years as a theater major. And it was weird for me as a theater major. I loved it, but all of my friends were these actor types, and they had all memorized the entire script to Glenn Gary, Glenn Ross, and they would break out into show tunes in the dining hall, and I was more into like reading the plays than being the star of them. By graduation time, I was feeling a lot of anxiety about what I should actually be doing with my life, and I was frequently throwing myself on the ground, crying, and debating between two career choices, which were moving to New York and pursuing a career as an actor, or becoming a sociologist who danced for fun on the side. So in the midst of one of these meltdowns I was having right before graduation, my roommate came in. This is year four of college, and she says, Margo, they've just announced our graduation speaker. And I was like, oh, because recent graduation speakers had been Maya Angelou and Ben of Ben and Jerry's, so it's like anything's possible, you know? It's a wide range we go for here. And she was like, it's him. I'm like, what do you mean it's him? And she points to the picture. She's like, it's Henry Winkler. He's coming to you. You summoned him. And I was like, oh my God. I had like a really like beta version of a vision board, just one thing. 4 years, and I got it. And I didn't even know I wanted it, you know? And so I was like, well, this is a sign. He's an actor. I should become an actor. I should do this. So I go to the graduation, and I put I taped the 8x10 glossy to the top of my graduation cap, and I go to hear him speak. And let me tell you, I thought it was a weird career pivot for Henry Winkler to be doing the speech, but at the same time, I have to say, no, it was not. He was the best speaker I have ever seen. It was amazing. He was a lot of, you know, the believe in yourself stuff, but there was also, he kept saying this quote, if you will it, it is no dream. If you will it, it is no dream, which for years of my life I attributed to Henry Winkler, and then I recently Googled it, and it was, no, it's Zionist Theodore Herzl that actually said it, and he was quoting him, but I've, you know, whatever, details, right? So I'm really moved by this speech, and I'm like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go to New York. And then my dad calls me. He's like, Margo, I got you a graduation gift. I got you tickets. Henry Winkler's on Broadway right now. And you're going to go see him on Broadway. And I was like, God, my dad, as a fellow New York Jew, was like, you love this other New York Jew, right? Right? Like, this is what we like in our family. So I'm like, okay. So he goes, here's the weird thing that happened to me. I go in to buy the box office to buy you the tickets as a gift. And guess who walked in right as I bought them? I go, Henry Winkler, obviously he's following me at this point. My dad's like, Henry Winkler comes in. So you know what I say to him? I say, oh my God, I just saw you talk at my daughter's graduation. She's a theater major. And he said, you tell her to come backstage. When she comes to this place, she's going to come backstage after. I'm going to give her a tour. I'm going to show the ropes. I'm going to talk to her about becoming an actor in New York. So he goes, so you better do that. And I was like, wow, another sign. So I go to the play. I feel uncomfortable after. My dad almost physically shoves me to the door. And he's like, you got to do it. So I go. And I'm expecting them to be like, he was just being polite. He didn't mean it. But they were like, no, he says, come on back. So I go back. Henry Winkler greets me with a smile. He gives me a tour. He talks to me all about graduating and how I feel about the theater. I meet his friend, his other friend that's backstage, Tyne Daly of Cagney and Lacey, which I feel like is like the perfect person for him to be hanging out with, you know? And then I'm overwhelmed by this generosity and his kindness. And I was like, my gosh, he's my guy. And then at the end of it, he took a picture with me. And I said, why do you want a picture with me? And he said, for my scrapbook, which is just the sweetest thing. So now I think, I'm going to do this. I'm going to pursue this. So I'm in New York. I'm going for it with acting. It doesn't really feel right. You know, at the time, Sex and the City is huge, and everyone's like, are you a Carrie or a Samantha or a Miranda or the other one? And I'm like, I don't want to be any of them. I want to be Candace Bushnell, the woman who wrote the book it's based on. That's the one I am. And no one cares. People don't understand what that means to want to write books. But I did. And I keep pursuing it. And then I get married, and I move to L.A. And before I go to L.A., my dad gives me this magnet for Christmas of Henry Winkler. as the Fonz, like, shaped as his body. It's really pushing it on me, you know? And I'm like, I like him. I'm convinced. He's great. He's the best. I love him. And so I bring in, it's on my fridge in L.A., and about a year in or so, I do sell a book, and it's really hard to get done, and I sell it. And before it comes out, I have all of this anxiety of, okay, what if it comes out and it's critically panned and everyone hates the book, or if it offends everybody and everyone's mad at me? You know, all of those feelings when you put a piece of art into the world, and I was very nervous about it. But what I didn't realize was there's a third option of it being a hit or a failure, which is that it comes out and no one notices and no one reads it, which is what happened. No one noticed my first book, and it was like the tree fell in the woods and no one heard it fall. And it was very questioning for me of, am I really going to do this? Am I going to be a starving artist for the rest of my life? But I managed to sell a second book, and I felt like things could be different with this. And I was getting in my car one day, and I was thinking about it. It was a couple months before my second book came out, and I thought, if this one isn't a hit, that's it. No one's going to give you a chance to write a third book. And you might have to be a sociologist who dances. I don't know. But this may not be working out for you, and you may just be a starving artist forever. So let's hope it works, because this is another shot. And I'm having all these doubts about myself, and I'm about to drive off, and I go to put the key in the ignition, and I look to the right of me, and in the seat of my passenger seat is just the head of the Henry Winkler magnet, broken off. I don't know how it got there. I didn't put it there. I didn't break my why would I break a head of a Henry Winkler magnet and shove it on a car seat? But he was there, and he was sitting with me kind of as my co-pilot. I have no idea how. And he was kind of looking at me like, hey, if you will it is no dream. Not my quote, but you know what I mean. And I was like, okay, I guess it's going to be okay. And I don't want to go into a whole raggedocious ordeal about it, but the second book came out, and it was a huge hit. And it was a life-changing piece of art to put out into the world. And it changed everything for me. And I went from starving artist to professional artist. And I'm not an actor by any means. It's not what I wanted to do with my life. But I am so thrilled that I get to make a living in the arts, and that's all I've ever really wanted. And it was amazing. And I thought, my God, I got my career on track. This is great. And then I realized that that's not all that matters in life, and that there's bigger hurdles ahead. It's not just getting your career on track, it's life, right? And so I have kids, and that's hard. And then I have a second kid, and right as I have the second baby, my husband has to travel a lot for work, and then I have to travel a lot for work, all with this under one-year-old child. And we move to a rental house, and then a few months after we move, they're going to sell the house, and we have to come up with all this money to buy a house in LA, or we're going to lose our house. It was lots of time apart, new baby, lack of sleep, financial stress, everything coming to a head, and I'd be lying to say that it wasn't really trying on us. And right at the end of all of this, as we're struggling to buy this house, my husband's father gets very ill and sadly passes away. And I was like, oh God, this is horrific and horrible and sad. And I don't know how we're going to get out the other side. And I don't know if life's going to be okay. The morning after the wake, I'm in the hotel room with my husband. And he goes to me, you know, it was weird. Last night at the wake, I met a guy there and his name was Michael Douglas. You know, like the actor, but not the actor. Just like same name as a famous person, but not that famous person. I go, yeah, that's weird. And he was like, yeah. Kind of like that weird make conversation about anything else that's going on besides the death, right? Then we go to the funeral, and it's terribly sad. Then we go to bury him in the mausoleum, and it's also terribly sad. And I'm standing behind my husband and his mother and his sisters. And my eyes are wandering, and I'm just thinking, like, adding grief on top of all of this stress and a death and everything that comes in the aftermath of a death is going to be even harder. And are we going to get through this? And is life going to ever be okay and stable and feel happy again? And I'm standing there, and I'm taking it all in, and my eyes kind of wander around. And I'm in the mausoleum, and I look at the stone right next to where his father's going to be put to rest. And on it, it says, loving father, husband and son, 1935 to 2016, Henry Winkler. Now, we all know he's alive. He just won an Emmy. This was another Henry Winkler. Same name as a celebrity, right? But not the celebrity. And of all celebrities, it was Henry Winkler, buried directly next to where my father-in-law is going to be buried. Now, a normal person, any of you, a nice person, would look at this, take it in, chuckle to themselves, and go on with their day, and respect the fact that their husband has just lost their father. Not me, no. I'm looking at this. I can't believe this has just happened. I mean, it keeps happening. He just keeps appearing. So I, as my husband is standing there, tears in his eyes, aggressively tap him. And I go, Dan, look at that stone. Henry Winkler. It's another Henry Winkler, like what we were just saying, but not him. But same name, right? What are the chances? And he looks at me and he doesn't say anything because it's inappropriate at this point to be talking at all. But with his eyes, he looks at me and I know exactly what he's saying. And what he's saying is, I am burying my fucking father, Margot. Give it a rest. Pause and I take it in. I kind of inappropriately smile because there he is again at another questionable moment in my life. And I think, you know what? If that's not a sign, guys, I don't know what is. Thank you.
Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday. My cycle humps, ready to race to you. These days are happy days. These days are share them with me.
This is Risk. This is Jim Hawes behind me now with the Happy Days theme song. Man, it's so surreal to look back at clips of that show. I mean, I used to watch that show every night that it was on back when I was a little kid, and it just feels like it might as well have happened in another universe, in another, you know, century. Well, it did happen in another century, but Christ, how things have changed. Our final story on this week's episode is one of our longer ones. It's a radio-style story. This is a very interesting case. Adam Strawn reached out to us. He's a Risk fan in Newcastle, in England. You know, we've recorded stories with people over Skype who were, at the time we were recording them, in Korea, in Argentina, Israel, I think Portugal once. So yeah, it's so exciting to actually work with people around the world who are fans of the show. When Adam first sent a recording of his story to us, it was maybe 10 or 12 minutes long, but the more we kind of worked with it, it became this beautiful long-form piece that our episode editor, Jeff Barr, edited. Adam has his own podcast called Pinpoint that you can find wherever podcasts are downloaded. And here he is now, Adam Strawn, with a story we call House on Fire.
I was sitting in my bedroom, staring at my computer screen, and I wasn't really taking in what was on the screen. I was elsewhere in my mind, and I was really concerned and more worried, apprehensive, and I just felt like a tightness inside. And I knew it was because of the email that I'd sent my parents the night before. And I was so worried about their reaction, so deeply worried about that, to the point of where I couldn't go downstairs. I'd woken up and I was sitting at my computer, and that's where I stayed. I did not feel comfortable going downstairs. And I just was racing through everything in my mind, thinking, what's their reaction going to be? What are they going to say? And then I heard footsteps, and that's when the panic set in. And the footsteps was somebody coming up the stairs. Now, it could have been my mum, could have been my dad, it could have been my brother, no idea. And then I heard the doorknob go, and that's when I froze in the chair. I couldn't move. So when the door opened, my mum came in. After a long silence of us looking at each other, and me kind of looking away, she just said to me, "Look, Adam, don't go near your dad. Just give him time. Don't hug him. Try not to be in the same room as him. He just needs time to accept this and get over this." And I said nothing. I couldn't say anything. I just couldn't believe what I just heard. And with that, she just bowed her head and closed the door. So in that email, I admitted the biggest secret that I'd been holding onto for my entire life was my sexuality. I was coming out to my parents. And it was always a struggle. It was always something that I felt like I couldn't tell them. But this moment of energy that just surged through when I sent the email and I thought, I've finally done it. I came out at the age of 26. I am now 31. So I waited a long time. And I knew for years and years and years since I was, 11, 12. But I always knew as well that it was something that it was my secret to keep. I couldn't tell my parents. It was something that I just couldn't share. And I think to understand that point, you kind of have to go back to understand my parents and their kind of upbringing and where they've come from. So my dad, when he was younger, he was born into extreme poverty. He lived in a household where sometimes he wouldn't eat. He had rooms in his house. Some of them didn't even have carpets. Some of them didn't have beds. And I remember he told me one story one time that always sticks with me, when he was so hungry one day and there was nothing in the house, nothing to eat. So he went next door to his neighbour's bin, and he opened the bin lid and he raided inside and found old potato peelings. So he took them back to his own home and he fried those peelings and he ate them that night. That's how little he had. He didn't want to become a victim of that situation. He didn't want to end up living a life growing up. He didn't want to provide a situation like that for his own family. He knew he wanted to evolve from that. My mum is a different story. She was raised in a house of war, basically, where her parents every night would fight. And when I say fight, I don't just mean argue verbally, which was a part of it, but I mean fist fight. And every Friday night she used to tell me, where her friends would be out, they'd be drinking, they'd be partying, they'd be having a good time. Her Friday nights was lying face down on her bed with her sister, with her pillow over her ears, trying to block out the sound of her parents screaming downstairs. And the sounds of her dad, my granddad, punching my grandmother. And that went on for hours until eventually she passed out. So when my mum and dad came to meet each other, which they met at a young age, they met at school. And I think when you level with somebody, you realise if you've come from somewhere of deep pain, you can sense that in other people. And I think they just connected on that level straight away. And, they developed a relationship. But from that, they agreed that they've both come from households, they've come from worlds that they want to get away from, and they want to create their own worlds. together. They both had that joint consensus. So that's what they decided to do. Now, there's a beauty in that they've found each other, that they've started to create their own world, but there's also a danger in that anything that they deemed as out of the ordinary, different, it was instantly rejected. It couldn't be part of their world, it was a no. And I think that's where that initial resistance came from. So as I was growing up, I remember one time I was sitting down with my mum, and we were in the living room, we were watching television, and we were watching an interview with Elton John, and he was being fabulous, as per, with his husband. And, you know, we were laughing and, like, we were just enjoying ourselves watching the show. But as it ended, I remember my mum, just her reaction was, isn't it weird just being gay? Isn't that just so wrong? Just being gay. At this point, I was maybe 15, 16. So I knew my sexuality. And that was the first moment that I thought, wow, I can't be myself around these people. This is going to be a secret now. And it's going to be a secret for a long time. Maybe a few years after that, when I was 18, 19, me and my dad were in the living room this time. And we were watching a UK chat show host called Alan Carr, who's openly gay and hilarious. So we were laughing and we were having a good time watching the show. And my dad's quite a big fan of his humour, so we were both laughing together. But he did something I'll never forget. And it still makes me cold to describe it now. But when the show ended, he just stood up so casually and he just turned to me and just went, yeah, that was really funny. But if it was up to me, he'd still be shot. And just nodded and just walked out of the room. As if he just said, yeah, it's a nice sunny day today. I was dumbfounded. And my mum was in the room. She was on the other side of the room, but she was on her laptop. Just typing away, looking at something. And I just turned to her and I looked, mouth open. And I said, did you just hear that? Can you believe what you've just heard? And she just looked up briefly, shrugged, and continued typing on her laptop. It was those two moments that cemented the thinking in me that I thought, I can't be myself, I can't open up, I can't. If that's the way he reacts to somebody he doesn't know, does that mean that if I open up, do I get shot? Do I get rejected? Or worse? So I knew this was going to be a secret I would keep for a long time, and I did. But when I turned 26, that was the year everything changed. Everything. It started when I just finished my dissertation, handed it in after a year's worth of work. That was that chapter done. And straight after, I met my brother in Manchester, and we travelled to London. And we were going for a big video game convention in Earl's Court, and we were so excited for it. Because I'm a massive geek, but whatever. So we got there, and there was a huge queue outside the building of all these avid gamers ready to go in, so excited. So we ran up and we joined the queue, and we could see signs outside of Microsoft, Sony, Nintendo, all this buzz in the air of people ready to go in and play new games. And as we were standing there, I was chatting, so my brother was next to me and we were talking, but my ears pricked because I heard an accent in front of me that I recognised, and it was my accent. Where I'm from is the northeast of England. I'm from a place called Newcastle. I studied in Manchester, and that's where I handed in my dissertation. And I thought, oh, I'm in London, and I thought maybe it was only us that had travelled this far to go to this convention. What I didn't realise was there was other people from my neck of the woods that were there. I thought, oh, shall I say something? Shall I not? Shall I ask if he's from there? And I just thought, oh, you know what? I'm in London. I'm vibing off this excitement, whatever. So I just said, oh, excuse me, can I just ask, are you from the northeast of England? Are you from Newcastle area? That's the moment when I met a really good friend to this day. It's a guy called Glenn. And he said, yeah, I'm from, you know, and he explained where he's from, and we were literally a half an hour drive from each other. And I was like, oh my God, isn't this surreal? Like, we've both traveled down, you know, from basically the same area. We don't know each other. How crazy. So we got on chatting, and we got on like a house on fire. One of the first things I noticed about Glenn was his confidence, but also how carefree he was. Now, he was 21 at the time. I was 26. This guy had way more confidence than me. He was so just out there. Nothing fazed him. He was up for anything. He was such just a great guy to talk to. As we kind of got to know each other on that day, we found out that we went to the same clubs as each other on nights out. We listened to the same music. We had the same taste in games, obviously. So we said to each other, right, when we get back to Newcastle after this weekend's over, we'll arrange it. We'll go on a night out. We'll have some drinks together. We'll go at the same bar. We'll just have a good time. We said, yeah, sure. After we got back to Newcastle, a couple of weeks went by and he contacted me and said, hey, Saturday's coming around. It's a great rock and metal night that's on in Newcastle. Do you want to come along? And I was like, yeah, like I always go there anyway. I'm surprised we'd never ran into each other because we both have been going for so long. That night, I went and met him at the club and we had a great time. We were catching up again, saying how crazy was that weekend that we met. I met some of his friends. He met some of mine. We just all gelled so well for a group that had never met each other before. It got to a point where it was quite regular, where every Saturday we'd go to the same club and we'd just have a great time. But it was maybe after the fourth or fifth time, so we started to really develop quite a friendship. And we'd had a few drinks, and towards the end of the night, like, things were mellowing out. And he turned to me and he just said, Adam, he said, I hope you don't feel like I'm being too forward when I ask this, but I just feel like you're holding something back. I just feel like there's something that... It's almost like you want to tell me, but you feel like you can't. And I just thought, right, this is the moment. He's clicking onto something. And I know the type of person he is. I know he's so carefree. He wouldn't give a shit. I can tell somebody now. This is my moment. I've got to take it. I just said, actually, Glenn, yeah, there is. And I just said it. I said, I'm gay. And the words, it just felt like a stone in my mouth. And I just spat it out for the first time because it'd been in there so long. And I just said, I'm gay. But the next words was almost, I'm sorry. I almost apologised to him straight after because I felt that he was going to react the same way my parents did. And he looked at me and just went, okay, all right, cool. And I was like, what? And he just went, yeah, all right. He said, yeah, my brother's gay. And I was dumbfounded. I just looked at him like, no one's given me this reaction, not a single person before. This is what I wanted from the people that I value so much in my life. And I didn't get that. I just got indifference and rejection. I couldn't believe it. And he said, you know what, Adam? I knew that you were gay from the moment I met you. But I felt like you were trying to convince me that you weren't. And he said to me, and these words will ring true for the rest of my life, it's not about making everyone else happy. Your happiness is what is important. There's nothing wrong with being gay, so what? You don't have to apologize to anyone. And I'll never forget that. Never. It was a huge moment for me. His reaction meant more to me than he probably will ever know. And it was so casual. And I was so shocked because the first thing I was expecting was just rejection. Or just indifference. I expected him to react like that, and the fact that I didn't get that reaction meant everything to me. I'm the type of person, I've always been this type of person, where I hate letting people down. I hate it. Whether it's telling a teacher, oh, I'm really sorry, I forgot my homework, to telling a friend, I'm really sorry, I can't meet up with you this night, I've got this thing, I can't, I'm really sorry. So when Glenn told me this, initially although I was ecstatic inside, but my mind went to this place of, yes, but my argument is, people won't be accepting. You are, and that's fantastic, but two people that are most important in my life won't accept me. So it's easier just to stay quiet and keep the status quo, to keep them happy, to keep everybody happy. And he just said to me, Adam, look, I'm going to be real with you for a moment. You're 26. You've known this for a while. Just tell them. Just do it in your own way, but just tell them. You've got nothing to apologize for. Just remember that. So I took a deep breath and I said, okay, I'll think about it. So that night I got home and I lay in bed for hours awake thinking how I would do it. How I would tell my parents that I'm gay. And I thought of different ways. I thought, shall I just casually throw it out? Shall I write it down? Everything went through my mind that night. I didn't get much sleep at all. So I literally rolled out of bed and I picked up my laptop and I typed it out. Everything. The subject of the email was, "I'm really sorry, but I've got something to say." So again, I was apologising straight away. But at least I had that initial strength that was built up by Glenn just to say, you know what, this is it. This is the moment. This is time. I might not be able to say the words, but I can damn well write them down and send you them. I wrote it out, and it was about a paragraph, and all it said was, "Mom, Dad, I think somewhere inside you must have known, but I've been keeping this to myself for too long now, and I feel like it's suppressing who I am, and I can't do this anymore. So I just said I'm gay. I'm really sorry, but I'm gay. I hope you can accept that. I don't want things to change. I want everything just to be the way it is. I don't want to upset anyone." And that was that. So this brings us back to the start of the story, when I woke up. And I didn't go downstairs because I didn't dare go downstairs. So I turned on my computer and I sat there. And I thought, I'll let them come to me because I can't go downstairs knowing they've got this information about me now. After my mum initially came into the bedroom and said this to me about my dad, she took my hand and said, "Come on, we'll try and talk to him." And I said, "What?" She said, "No, come on, we'll go and speak to your dad." Before I could say anything, she kind of pulled me out of my chair and we walked downstairs together. My legs were jelly. I was a mess. And I just thought, I didn't know what to say to him. I thought it was all there in the email, just read it again. But he was in the kitchen, and we walked in, and he had his back to me the whole time. He didn't turn round once, and he was washing the dishes. And my mum stood next to me, and all I could say, all that would come out was just the word "Dad," but it was so meek, just "Dad." And I was fighting back tears. I thought, no, I'm not going to break down now. I'm not going to do it. I've had so much strength in finally admitting I'm not breaking down now. The whole time he spoke to me, he didn't turn round. And he just said, "Son, this is a decision that you've made. You've decided to be this way. That's your choice. I don't accept it. I don't want a part of it. But if you want to live your life like that, that's completely your choice. But I won't accept it." And there was a pause for a long time as he continued washing the dishes. And I watched him do it because I just had nothing to say. I couldn't believe it. I looked at my mum for support and she just had her head bowed. She didn't want to go against my dad. So it was them two against me, practically. And then after a long pause, he then said, "I think you've been really selfish telling us this. You know how we would react. You know how we'd feel about this. And the fact that you've dropped this on us, I think you've been really selfish." Inside, I was screaming. I was like, selfish? Fucking selfish? I've kept this to myself for years because I knew how you would react. And I said nothing because I wanted to make sure that you were happy, that you got the son that you wanted, that I wasn't going to be this person that you didn't like. And I'm fucking selfish for doing that. I was irate. But my face didn't show it at that point. I was bubbling inside, but I just looked away. I couldn't say anything at that point. I knew if I exploded, I wouldn't be able to stop. So I knew I just did not want to go there. As he walked out of the kitchen, he didn't look at me. My mum reiterated the instructions that I was given. Don't try and give him a hug. Try to not be in the same room as him. Don't go near him. Just leave him, Adam. Leave your dad. So we had a couple of months of this, where he would be in the living room, I would be upstairs. He would go in the kitchen, I'd walk through the living room to avoid him. If he was in the house at certain hours of the day, I wouldn't be in. It went on like this for at least 2-3 months. But slowly things started to return back to status quo. And by that, I don't mean acceptance. I mean that I could be in the same room as him, that he would actually talk to me. And I thought, well, I'll take this over, making it awkward for the rest of the family. I guess I'll take this on the chin again. I don't want to put my brothers in an awkward situation, so I'll just carry on. We'll treat it like the elephant in the room, I guess. I spoke to my brothers about it, to admit my honesty about my sexuality. I've got two brothers, an older and a younger. My older brother didn't live with us at the time, but my younger brother, Andrew, I asked him about it and I said, what do you think? He said, I don't understand why they've reacted that way. He said, I feel so sorry for you, for everything you've had to go through, for the fact you've had to keep it to yourself. But I think because in my mind, he's my brother and he's connected to my parents in the way that I am. So by extension, I kind of almost thought that he would react the same way. But he's so laid back. He couldn't give two shades of shit. It wasn't an issue. Just, okay. So my older brother, he was married at the time, and his wife, her sister was a lesbian. She was fine, completely fine. She'd grown up in a household where it's never been an issue. And my older brother, again, the most sweetest, laid-back guy in the world. Everybody loves him because of how loving and caring he is. And I told him, I said, Gavin, I've got something to tell you. I need to tell you this because I'd rather you hear it from me than from somebody else in the family. And I just said, Gavin, I'm gay. I've just told our mum and dad, I've told our Andrew. I need you to know now, and I need to know how you feel about that. And he just said, Adam, finally. I've waited for you to say this to me for years. He said, I've always had an inkling, but it's not been my place to say anything. I'll always love you and I'll always support you. But he said, I'm so pleased. He said, I'm so happy for you, that you feel like you can be yourself now. He said, I'm so happy for you. He pulled me into a big hug. He said, I don't want you ever to worry about this. He said, you're always welcome at our house. If you ever need to get away, if you ever need a place of refuge, you're always welcome here. And that meant everything to me. Everything. That's what I wanted. That's the reaction I wanted. Not this resistance. Not this weird, let's not talk to each other reaction. Anyway. Time went on with this weird normality, and we kind of got back to the way things were, I guess, with my parents, where we didn't talk about it, but they knew, so it was weird. But things changed again when I got my first boyfriend. So I started a new job, and I met him there. And it was that kind of initial thing of where we looked at each other and we were sussing each other out. And I thought, yeah, I know why you're looking at me, and you should know why I'm looking at you. But yeah, we got on like a house on fire, and he invited me over to his, and we just chatted a lot more, and we started to see each other a lot more, and then things just went from there, until eventually we admitted, yeah, we were in a relationship. My first relationship at the age of 27. Now, my first gay relationship. I'd been with women before, trying to prove something to myself, but there was always something that was just lacking in those relationships. I never felt fully myself or fully happy. But now I did. Now with my partner I did. He comes from a different background. He's been openly gay since the age of 11. And his parents were amazing. They've got loads of gay friends. Not an issue to them. For him to watch me in pain, to tell him this, to tell him my parents' reaction, was such a shock to him. He didn't know that people could react like that, because he had the complete opposite reaction to what I had. As time went on, I started to spend a lot more time at his flat. He lived in Newcastle. I worked in Newcastle. It made sense to stay with him. So I used to spend a lot of time there. And I thought, you know, my parents aren't daft. They're going to click on. They're going to know that I'm spending a lot of time out of the house. I'm not obviously sleeping at work. I've clearly met somebody. So I've got to tell them. And I said, look, I've got myself a partner. It's a guy. I'm seeing a guy. We've been seeing each other for a few months now. I'm really happy. It kind of felt like we went back to square one. My dad said nothing, but he looked away from me. My mum bowed her head, said nothing. So I said to them, through this act of courage, I know we've got a big family christening coming up. I want to invite my partner. I want you guys to get to meet him. I want to be able to introduce him to the rest of the family, and I want to be able to feel happy about that. I want to enjoy that. I want to feel confident and be able to express that I'm in this new relationship. I'm so happy. And I want my family to know. All of my family. My dad just turned to me and he said, you want to treat this christening like your coming out party. And that's not fair, Adam. And I remember I raised my eyebrows and I just said, okay. I left the room and I went upstairs. and my brother was in the room, and I opened a suitcase and I started packing. And I said to my brother, I'm done. And he said, why, what's the matter, what's the matter? And I told him, and he said, what? I said, yeah, no. And I said, Andrew, I can't stay in this house anymore, I can't do it. Every time I talk about this, I'm going to get this reaction. I am not suppressing myself anymore, I'm done. I'm happy, I'm beyond this now. I'm living the life that I've wanted to live for so long, and I am not about to give this up. Not for that reaction. And he said, I don't blame you for reacting this way. Call me, keep in contact with me, don't lose contact with me. Grabbed my suitcase, and I walked downstairs, and my parents were still sitting there. I walked past them, grabbed my car keys, and I just left. Didn't even say goodbye, didn't look at them. That night I drove to my partner's, and when I got there, I think I just had a mask of sorrow just on my face. And he looked at me and he just gave me the biggest hug. And he said, are you all right? And I said, I just need to tell you what's happened. So I explained everything to him. And he said, Adam, he said, you stay here for as long as you want. You call this your home now. You're free to stay here as long as you want. He said, if you never want to go back, that's your choice. You stay here. And I said, oh, thank you so much. And he just said, I can see so much hurt behind your eyes, and it hurts me to see you that way. And he said, I want to see you happy again. I said, I want to see you smile again. He said, if that means you staying here, he said, you stay as long as you want. So I did. I stayed maybe a month with no interaction with my parents, nothing. No text messages, no phone calls, no Facebook updates, no social media, nothing. I literally got up with my partner, went to work, came back to his home, which I started to call my home, and we did our thing. We chilled, we watched films, we started to build our own little life together, really, kind of starting to understand what it was like to live together and be in a relationship. It felt like that came a lot quicker than what probably it should do in normal relationships, I guess, but that didn't matter to me. That didn't matter to him because we were happy. And I was happy again, and I put that sorrow behind me. There was always a little bit of something at the back of my mind, and it was the fact that I'd lost contact with my parents. It was always there, and it was always a moment of sadness that I guess I had to myself from time to time over that month. I kept reminding myself of the way that they reacted and the words that they said, and I knew that I'd made the right decision. I also knew that in a week, my mum's birthday was coming up. And as a family, every year, we've always gone for a family meal on my mum's birthday. It's the way it's always been. And I thought, right, what do I do? Because I really don't feel like going at all. I miss my brothers, but I don't feel like going to see them. That night, I got a phone call off my mum when I was walking back from work. I thought, this is uncanny. I was just thinking about this. And I looked at my phone for a minute, thinking, should I answer, should I not? I know what it's going to be about. Should I answer this call? Do I reject this? Do I cut all ties and just continue living my life the way it is? Or do I extend an olive branch in hope that something's improved? So I answered, and I said, hi, Mum. And there was silence for a while. And she just, with almost a quiver in her voice, just said, Adam, I need to know if you're coming to my birthday. I need to know. And I could hear she was upset. She said, I can't imagine having my birthday without you being there. I can't. And this gave me a choice. This was like a fork in the road where I thought, I can either go down the harsh route, cut all ties and say, I won't be there, don't call me again. Or I can try and talk things out and see if they've made any improvements, see if they've evolved, see if they've progressed in any way with everything. So I just said, look, Mum, let me put it this way. I don't want to miss your birthday, but I feel like you're making me. You know the way you've reacted to me, you and Dad. If you keep pushing me away, what do you think will happen? I'll walk away. I'll walk away and I won't come back. And I heard her begin to sob on the phone. And she said, Adam, things have changed. I need you to come to my birthday. Let us explain in person. And I said, okay. And I thought in my mind, this is the last chance. This is the last chance. And I'm going kind of for her sake, kind of a little bit for my sake, for my brother's sake, and more of a curiosity to see how things have changed, especially with my dad. So I got home to my partner's flat and I said, look, I've just had a phone call off my mum. And he was like, really? How are things? Is everything all right? And he looked at me and I had a sense of determination now. I wasn't upset. I wasn't angry. I was just determined. And I told him the conversation. And I said, I want to go, but I want to see how things have changed. And if I get one glint of things being the same, I'm out of there. And that'll be me done. And he said to me, look, Adam, you need to go alone. He said, you need to go to that birthday alone. He said, we don't want a christening number two if I came along with you. He said, you need to go to that alone and you need to do this for yourself. You know, and he said, just be strong, but you go along. He said, if you need me at all, he said, you know where I am. So that week came, the day of my mum's birthday. A couple of days before, I sent her in the post a new shirt for her birthday. And I sent her a card from Adam and Kane, not just Adam, from me and my partner. And in there I wrote, this is a gift from us both. So I was intrigued to see how their reaction would be to the card and also the gift. I got to the restaurant and my parents and brothers were waiting outside and my mum clocked me and the first thing I noticed is she had the shirt on. She had the birthday shirt on and that was sign number one where I thought, she's making an effort here, so maybe, just maybe. But she came straight over to me. She left my dad and brothers, ran over to me and gave me a big hug. And she said, Adam, I'm so happy you're here. I'm so happy you're here. Thank you so much for being here. And she pulled me in closer and she whispered in my ear and she said, look, Adam, your dad won't admit this to you, but I'm going to tell this to you now. He's been walking past your bedroom nearly every night since you've left. And he's looked in and he's just said, I really miss our Adam. I really miss our Adam. And that meant everything to me. Everything. That felt like acceptance. Felt like he knew the person that I was now and he missed me. And I thought, okay, maybe things are changed. Maybe things are different. So I walked over with my mum to meet the rest of my family. My brothers gave me a big hug. But it's when I turned to my dad, that's when I was ready. And I thought, this is either the moment that'll make things different, or it'll break and I'll go. And he had a huge smile on his face. And he pulled me in for a hug. And that's the first time I'd hugged my dad in maybe 6 months. And it felt like everything. He didn't say anything, but that hug said everything. And I knew, I felt an acceptance, a warmth at last. We walked in and we sat down and we had a meal and we were talking as a family and it felt nice. We were talking about how things were, how things had been. My brothers were talking about their lives, my mum and dad were talking about work and how things were at home. And I thought, right, well, seems that we're all being open, I'm going to talk about my partner. So I told them about my partner, Kane. And at first I thought, right, are they going to look away? Is this the point where they turn away and say nothing? But it's my dad that turned to me and said, oh, what does he do for a living? My mum said, oh, so how are things? Whereabouts does he live? Mind blown. Blown away. It's like, oh my God, like this is the conversation I've waited so long for. And I never thought I'd get. This is the complete polar opposite reaction to what I thought I would get. I thought I would turn up and I'd walk away. But you know what? I went for it. I told them everything. I said, this is a guy who I'm really starting to fall for. He's a really nice guy. He's really looked after me. And I think you guys will really get on with him. And they kind of agreed. They said, yeah, sounds like a great guy. We're looking forward to meeting him. And that meant everything. Again, we're looking forward to meeting him. By extension, my partner also became another secret of mine that I almost couldn't talk about. But now I could. It was all out in the open. They knew everything. And I kind of watched their reaction as they said the words, we look forward to meeting him. And I watched to see if that was through gritted teeth, whether that was hard. but it came so natural, and that was for both of them, my mum and dad, and they both agreed, and I thought, this is amazing. So at the end of the meal, I gave everybody a big hug. As I was walking back, I got a text message off my mum as I got to my car, and she said, we really want to meet your partner. When can we meet? Tell us a date and we're there. And I thought, oh, finally. I got in my car and I was driving back to the flat that night, and the song Gods and Monsters by Lana Del Rey was on the radio. I love that song. But there's one lyric in particular that stood out that night in the song, and it's the lyric, no one's going to take my soul away. And it really hit me. And I listened to that song, and I listened to it again, and it connected with me. I thought, no one is going to take who I am away from me now. People know who I am. I am expressing myself in ways I've never done before. But I finally feel I can be me without being judged, without being harassed, without thinking that I'm going to upset somebody or have to apologize, because this is me. And no one is going to take my soul away from me. No one. So I got back to the flat, and my partner was standing there with his arms folded like, well, expecting the worst. And I told him everything. A massive smile crept across my face and I said, you'll never guess what. And I relayed the whole night to him that the part he squealed at was, and they really want to meet you. He was like, what? I was not expecting this at all. Like, okay. So he ran and got his diary and he was like, right, let's do this. So we looked when we were free, and it was a week. So we'd met on Saturday. It was the next Saturday we were free. I said, right, why don't the four of us sit down in a restaurant and we'll just talk and we'll get to know each other. The week went by. I had a mixture of emotions about the meal again, I guess, because it's still in my mind, I still thought they could at any moment just turn this on its head. They could just say one thing and just ruin this perfect moment that I've been building for so long. But we were dressed up to the nines and we left the flat. We both looked fab. And as we were walking down the street to the restaurant, I turned to Kane and I said, look, I just want to get this out the way now. And this is the only rule I kind of want to set for the night, but I'm not bothered how they make me feel. But if they make you feel uncomfortable at any point, you tell me and we'll go. Because I'm not having that. So when we got there, we met just outside the restaurant, and my mum and dad were there, and we went over. I hugged my mum. My mum pulled Kane in for a big hug. My dad did the handshake, and I thought, well, that's step number one. You know, he's greeting them, he's acknowledging them, and he's making an effort. Maybe it's for me, but in order to make an effort, you've got to make a bit of an effort for yourself as well. And he's doing this, and I noticed a change in him. So we were chatting, and we said, look, should we go and get our table? So we went upstairs, and I purposely sat opposite my mum, so he, Kane, could sit opposite my dad. I purposely did that, because I thought, you guys are going to talk. I'm going to talk to my mum, but I'm going to listen the whole time. So food came, and we began chatting, and I was just catching up with my mum. I said, oh, look, your birthday last week was lovely. I'm so pleased that, you know, we came along. The food was nice. But the whole time my mum was talking, I kind of feel a little bit bad about this, but whatever. She was kind of talking, but I kind of wasn't listening, because what was going on in the conversation next to me was so much more important than that point. My dad and Kane were getting on like a house on fire, and that's where my attention was. So my mum was kind of getting the, yeah, lovely, She could have been telling me that the house burned down, but I was like, yeah, okay, wonderful, because I was too focused on this conversation that was happening. They were talking about films that they shared. They were talking about music that they shared. The big thing is running. Kane's a big runner, and my dad's a big runner, and they just connected on that level, talking about marathons, half marathons, times that they've made. I'm not a runner, so that didn't make a lot of sense to me, but the fact that they connected on something that they could just share and just get amongst, just it was a joy to watch, just them riff off each other like that, which I never expected. After the meal, we went downstairs, and we were still talking, me and my mum, Kane and my dad behind me, and we left the restaurant. We got to the point where we were going to part ways. We were going to go back to the flat. Mum and dad were going to go back to their car and drive home. So my dad pulled me in for a big hug. As I gave my mum a hug, I looked over her shoulder, and I expected the handshake. But my dad pulled Kane in for a hug. I just remember looking over thinking, wow, I can't believe how far you've come in a matter of months, not even a year. I've waited for that for so long, so long. And I know you're not hugging me right now, but you're hugging everything that means everything to me. And it was just amazing. It really was. I remember thinking, 2 months ago that wouldn't have happened. A year ago that wouldn't have happened. It just opened my perspective completely. That people can change. That people can see the hurt that they've put you through. But people can open the perspective when they allow themselves to. And I think in that moment they realised how important my happiness was to them, finally. One of the most important things is to never assume anything. I think they went into that thinking that it was going to be such a negative for them, that it was going to be something that they couldn't handle. But they were so wrong. In moments like that, I think in life, just prove how preconceptions could be so wrong. There can be such a stall on how you can take things and how you can accept things. They can put such a block on a part of life that you can miss out because you've preconceived something in such the wrong way. But the fact that they pushed through that meant that they opened themselves up to this new form of happiness that they knew, that they never knew about. They could see their son happy, fully himself. And that meant the world to me. And where are things now? My mum and dad adore Kane. They adore him. They want to see him more than me. But whenever he comes over to the house, they laugh, they share stories, they talk about good times, we share stories about our time together, our holidays together, work, how we just thrive now. And it's the polar opposite compared to how things were, how stale and stagnant things were. But I think the cherry on top of the cake, which is already a beautiful cake now, but the cherry on top is that my dad, whenever I ask him about Kane, he always says, I have a new son now. What more can I say?
That is all for this week's episode, folks. This is Lana Del Rey behind me now, and we just heard from Adam Strawn. Now, you can find him on Twitter and Instagram at Strawn87. That's S-T-R-A-U-G-H-N. 87. By the way, our story coaches and producers, Brad Lawrence and Cindy Freeman, also did a lot of behind-the-scenes work on that story. So big love to Brad and Cindy. While we're listening to Lana Del Rey, I want to give a shout-out to Laura DeLong, who is our latest Patreon supporter who's giving $25 or more a month. We always give a shout out to someone who gives that much or more. And you know, there's a lot of bonus content on our Patreon if you go there. I'm about to record an Ask Me Anything that we're going to upload this week. And, you know, there's lots of bonus stories there as well. So check it out at patreon.com/risk. Because we really need the financial support of our fans in order to keep all of this running. Did you know that there's a Risk Podcast fans discussion group on Facebook? That is where most people like to come and talk about their thoughts and feelings about the stories that they hear on the podcast. You can also leave comments on the listen pages at risk-show.com. We always love hearing your reactions to what you've heard on the show. So, you know, get engaged that way as well. Don't forget, you can always find new information about where the next Risk Live shows are happening at risk-show.com/tour. And all of the storytelling education that we do is at thestorystudio.org. Be sure to look us up there as well. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk. This is heaven, what I truly want. It's innocence lost. Innocence lost.